The Iranian war looks like it's about to escalate yet another level. President Trump just hours ago, or less than 2 hours ago, posted on his Truth Social that every time Iran kills an American soldier, they will pay for that killing many times over. This directive has been passed on to the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Daniel Kane, and every leader in the military, President Trump. Well, it's unclear exactly what he's going to do. We've been striking for 9 straight days. It's not sure what we're going to do that's going to be any different here, but there have been some Americans killed. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But where is this war going? And if this doesn't cause the war to end, if it doesn't cause the Iranian side to capitulate, what next? What are we going to do? And we have back with us today Robert Barnes, who is going to be it's from the constitutional lawyer from the Barnes Law, vivabarneslaw.locals.com. And he's, I think that's his Substack. No, is that your Substack? I forget.
Oh, yeah. Just opened up a new Substack. So got that. And then for all the big public cases and controversies and the upcoming conference, that's at 1776lawcenter.com.
Which I will be very happy to participate now, less than a couple of weeks away, I think. We'll be talking about that more, too. But let's get to this first thing here, because there have been now some additional Americans killed. There were this basically 4 in the last couple of days, 3 in Jordan, 1 in Kuwait. I'm sorry, 1 in Iraq that was just killed. Private Isabella Gonzalez here, and that brings the number to 16 killed in action. At least officially, somewhere around 430 wounded in action, which we're now up to. I suspect it's probably a lot more than that because CENTCOM is anything but forthcoming. And so, President Trump, what can President Trump do? Because he started this war, which was foolish, and we think he should have gotten out of it. But now, here again, because of these nightly raids that we brag about doing all the time, now all of a sudden we're starting to get casualties again. But what are his hands tied when he gets a casualty like this?
Oh, his hands definitely are not tied. His hands are tied in general. He can there was no need to go back into this. There was no need to breach the original ceasefire on April 8th. There was no need to get into this war in the first place. The reason why he went into the war in the first place, the reason why he breached the original ceasefire agreement that would have had the strait open all the way back at the beginning of April, the reason why he breached the memorandum of understanding throughout its short-lived existence, and the reason why we've now gone back in militarily again, kinetically again, to losing the lives of American soldiers for no purpose, really, no good purpose, no effective purpose, is because delusional Trump keeps relapsing into delusional Trump. That you get him sane and sober mentally for maybe a week or two, like you did during part of the memorandum of understanding, and then it's back to a delusional Trump. That he truly convinces himself that if he escalates the threats, Iran will capitulate. He only sees two things. He doesn't see compromise as a solution. It has to be capitulation or conquering. If they aren't capitulating and he isn't conquering, he won't accept it. And so he was okay with the compromise for a period of time as long as he could pretend Iran was capitulating in it when it was us capitulating in it. And as that dawned on him, he basically started sabotaging it, undermining it, betraying it in every possible conceivable way, red-pilling it. Currently, Vice President Vance is trying to negotiate a deal that more explicitly recognizes at least a short-term extension, as was floated by Qatar, for at least a couple of weeks or so, to stabilize things that would recognize formally and fully Iran's control of the Strait of Hormuz. That there would still be an Omani route like there was before. Iran didn't have a problem with the Omani route. They had a problem with people not checking in with Iran before they used it. So right now, Vance is floating that possibility. Problem is, can Trump take it? You never know. I mean, Trump goes bad various days. And the key problem is Trump's delusional state of mind. He truly, these days, he convinces himself the good thing will happen, the bad thing won't. The good thing will happen, the bad thing won't.
Let me ask you to kind of go into a little bit more depth on that. So on the 17th of June, when he signed the Memorandum of Understanding, later that day he had a press conference where he was asked, just entertaining all of the questions that people were asking. It was actually answered. And a couple of them, Gary and I were both kind of like, whoa, he was actually honest with that. Two of the things he said there really stood out. One is he said, hey, our strategic petroleum reserve was down to like 4 weeks. We had to get this thing done because otherwise we were going to be in real trouble. And by the way, I don't want to be a President Hoover, the one that presides over a depression which was going to be possible if we didn't get this thing open. So we had to. And I thought, okay, we've been saying that. I think even you and I have talked about the financial potential if we hadn't have done the MOU. And we thought, okay, great. Finally, he recognizes it. But then and we've done the timeline here. 7 days later, on the 24th of June, that's when the news breaks that the UN and Oman have opened the southern corridor and that they're going to start letting traffic. They're going to decide who goes through, despite what paragraph 5 said that only Iran could, et cetera. And then, of course, we all know what happened after that. And they struck the ships. We struck them. And now them here, we're back in this back and forth. Now Trump's saying stuff. Gary, let's look at this one. Trump falling like this.
Well, we feel very badly, but, you know, those great people, those great patriots were out there fighting that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. Iran has been very, very badly damaged. They've lost everything almost militarily. They've got very little left.
What do you mean they've lost everything military and they've got nothing left? Then there wouldn't have been an memorandum of understanding. There would have just been a demand for unconditional ceasefire or unconditional surrender, which he had said earlier in the war. Can you walk us through, as best you can piece together, the Trump on the 17th of June and the Trump yesterday?
So Trump has been told throughout, occasionally Hegseth and Rubio lie and mislead to him, and same with Ratcliffe, that led him down the China path on the election, for example. But Vance has broken through most of the, well, put it this way, Vance has relayed to him repeatedly that this information that he's putting out there is inaccurate and untrue. He was even back in the summer of 2025, as has now been published in the book Regime Change by the New York Times and Axios writers, telling Trump not to use the word nuclear program obliterated because it was not likely accurate. So he has told them all the way through, they still continue to have weapons, they continue to have drones, they can continue to manufacture them, we can't reach them, there's nothing we can do to open the strait militarily, that this is the reality. And what will happen is, some days, when Trump decides that's the appropriate path, on days that he's mentally sober, he'll accept that, like he did during much of the time period when he signed the Memorandum of Understanding at Versailles. He recognized the economic risk is severe, the energy risk is severe, the geopolitical risk was growing and accelerating as the Gulf states reconsidered their relationship with the United States at a very, very fundamental level, and that Iran was becoming a regional power, and Russia and China were stronger through this war, not weaker. But then he could, what it is when he gets enough criticism from the Fox Generals crowd, and the Lindsey Graham is gone, so at least he doesn't have that person worm-tonguing him constantly. But while he was around, people like Graham, like Hannity and others, he convinces himself that he didn't need to do this, if he'll go back in kinetically, the good things will happen and the bad things won't. He sounds identical to a Fox News general. So when people like Vance and Kane and other people are sitting there in the room with him saying, no, that they're wrong, that's not going to happen, he says, no, you guys are wrong, you don't understand. The good thing is absolutely going to happen. The bad thing's not going to happen. You just don't understand. You don't understand how great I am. You don't understand how insignificant this is. And he just keeps relapsing back into delusional Donald. And while he's there, he stays there. And pulling him out is brutal. Even when the military on the ground is saying this is not working and is undue and unnecessary risk, as our losses publicly accumulate, we probably have more, particularly wounded, that have been acknowledged and admitted. CENTCOM has implicitly recognized today that they have not been forthcoming and forthright about that information for operational security purposes. I know people like you and Larry Johnson and others were highlighting that at the beginning. People are like, oh, no, they're legally obligated to disclose. There's excuses and loopholes, and they're using them, sadly. I think when the real numbers are done, we're going to have over 1,000 wounded in this conflict and more deaths than have been publicly reported, particularly if you include people that are not in official military uniforms. We got plenty of people in the Middle East that are still technically private contractors and the like, or not necessarily assigned to a military branch that are involved in these activities. So it's an utterly unnecessary war. It's a counterproductive war. But the problem is a combination of Trump's diminished decision-making capacity, where he lives in a fantasy land of his own making, and his cabinet of cowards. that so many of them, Hegseth won't push back. He even pretends he goes along with the delusion. Rubio often won't push back and goes along with the delusion. Bessett won't push back at all. He's a complete wuss. Energy Secretary Wright is humiliating himself on a global stage on a daily basis. This is a man who came in with a big public reputation in the energy sector as well-respected and well-regarded in the energy world. And he has to get out there every day and spin. Oh, no, the strait is open. Totally open. Totally open. Everything's coming through just fine. And, you know, everybody in the energy sector is sitting there and laughing at him. He's becoming a laughing stock. They're going through humiliation rituals to stay in the cabinet. And the only guy pushing back at all is Vance, and then people within the Defense Department, Undersecretary of Defense Elbridge, Colby, and his deputy. Everybody else is now gone. Gabbard gone. Fox gone. Kent gone. Michael Anton gone. There's other people, Jeremy Carl and other people that were going to come in, out. So not even allowed in some cases, or pushed out at the last second. So all you have are cowards for the most part, other than Vance and Colby. And
you know, it's interesting you mentioned Wright because he was on Fox News earlier today. I'm going to get to some of these TV generals and admirals you were talking about a second ago. But, man, this one deserves special award, I think, for being the most amazing. He was asked to set up this soundbite you're going to hear. He was first asked, hey, is there going to be a big retaliation against Iran because they've been killing our soldiers? Now, as you watch this, tell me if this looks like a real video or if this looks like a very poorly constructed AI Ottoman person.
Yeah, look, the president's mission is essential for peace in the Middle East and peace in the world, and that is to prevent Iran from achieving nuclear weapons and to degrade their ability to terrorize their neighbors and the world and global commerce. So, yes, this mission will go on until the mission is done.
But I'm asking you, does he plan retaliation for the killing of those U.S. service members?
It's a tragic to lose American lives, but this is a mission that will save countless lives going forward. His focus is on degrading the Iranian ability to terrorize the world, to hold world commerce hostage as they are doing right now, and to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. That is unchanged.
I mean, it doesn't even look like a real human talking. I'm being serious. It looks like an AI generated video because his cadence is off. It's not. What do you make of that?
I've seen hostage videos more credible. That's what it really looked. It was a little bit of confession through projection there. Because he knows that he keeps coming back. Hostage, 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 hostage. I'm hostage. Please, somebody see. You know, he did everything but giving the special Morse code with his eyes. So I know he's humiliated by this. He told Trump before the war that this would be an energy debacle and disaster and that we were not in a position to withstand it for very long at all. He's the one who kept hammering. He even organized all the oil execs to come in right before the MOU was signed to tell Trump in person, we're 4 weeks off from the cliff. We're 4 weeks from the cliff. We're 4 weeks from the cliff. That's why Trump relayed it. So I feel bad for Wright because I know that behind the scenes he's advocated literally the opposite of what he's having to spin, and I don't think it's a coincidence his mind stuck on the word hostage. It's driving him. Remember, he was the one at the beginning of the war left behind. He wasn't brought with down to Mar-a-Lago when they launched it, and that's because he had opposed it. He had said this won't work energy wise. We are not in a position to manage this. And then today the Houthis announced no more Saudi oil coming out. Period. Not out of the Hormuz, not out of the other
street.
Yeah, exactly. I'll let you pronounce it. I butcher the word pronounce, so I let other people pronounce things that have any degree of complexity. That's basically 20 million barrels. Or 20%, because you include both, you get about 25 to 30% of the world's oil and natural gas supply. The Saudis were increasing their use of that alternative route. My understanding, about 7 million barrels a day. So we just went from 13 million barrels offline to 20 million barrels offline. In a place that they can paper manipulate the market all they want. If you look at the crack spreads, that will tell you the true price at the port and at the pump for diesel and jet fuel and gas. And what that is screaming at you, because we've got a huge so-called crack spread when you crack the barrel of oil into gasoline and other distillates and diesel and jet fuel, that price differential shouldn't be that big. And everybody assumes it's that big because they're just making huge amounts of profits. Often that's not the case. Often it's because the paper price doesn't match the price that the refiners are having to pay to get it. And so the real sourcing price. So you look at that real sourcing price, that's more like $120 to $140 a barrel, and it shows up in the actual cost. Like, you look at the taco index. By the taco index, we should expect Trump to taco very quickly, because that is the 10-year over 4.5. It is. It's there and climbing. Is his approval ratings in the 30s? They are, and they've stayed there, and they're declining. And then is the price of gas and diesel at the pump, diesel over 5 and gas over 4? Well, it just crossed over the $4 average in the U.S. and has already crossed over the $5 average for diesel. And diesel, of course, goes into everything for shipping and farming. So it usually is a major input cost that either ends up translating to, like some people are saying, hey, maybe it won't translate to the Walmarts and the Costcos. That's an even worse sign, because that means that there's demand destruction occurring. That they, if they can't transfer those prices and they have to eat those prices, the only reason they're going to do so is because people are struggling and suffering economically so bad that they can't afford to buy it anymore. And then you're in a deep recession. And there's already indicators that that's the case. So there's no scenario. It either results in major cost of living affordability problems or a different kind of affordability problem. I can't even afford to buy it, period. And so either way, the economy, all the taco index is there. But Trump is going increasingly so delusional and locking himself up into more and more bubbles that people like Vance struggle to get through, because Vance is increasingly the more isolated voice, because Fox is doubling down on this. I mean, at the end of the day, Fox News is as guilty for this war escalating as anybody else anywhere. Rupert Murdoch's ability to put nutty generals on every single night and preach utter gibberish and nonsense. This will be easy. That will be easy. They'll fold. They have to capitulate. Trump can't walk it back. They've had more influence in the Israel lobby over the last 3 months.
Then that's a big question that you come up. Well, I did a show on, I think it was Friday, to where I just said, look, I had 5 sound bites from either generals or retired Mike Pompeo, retired Secretary of State, just from one afternoon, and every single one of them were saying exactly what you would expect. The war is going to go on. We're definitely going to win. We have to just go back and finish the job, all this kind of stuff. Why does Rupert Murdoch want to push the administration in a path that will harm America and ultimately harm him? What is their motivation?
That's always been interesting with Murdoch. In other words, why has Murdoch been such a war whore throughout his, I mean, he's an Aussie. He's not an American. Why does he care so much? Why has he been so invested in this? Because he went all in on, you know, back in the day, you could rationalize it as it was part of the Bush administration, and he was trying to build credibility with the conservative Republican base in order to establish Fox News' monetary engine. But he's lobbied this aggressively all the way into the war. He's used all of his publications. The Daily Mail in the UK has taken all kinds of pot shots at J.D. Vance, as has the New York Post. The New York Post, the Daily Mail, the Wall Street Journal, and Fox News, all Murdoch outlets, have lobbied like madmen for this war, advocated for this war, attacked any effort to resolve this war, undermine and sabotage any effort to win this, to be able to get out of this war diplomatically. And cheerlead with level, knowing that Trump is losing it. There are people at Fox that know that Trump is not all there anymore, and that you can cheerlead him like a toddler into jumping off off a cliff that just takes the whole world with him. And that is an open question to me. I know he's long been a war whore, but why has never been fully or satisfactorily explained to me.
It's one thing to be a war whore because you have this perverted idea that you can accomplish something here. But when you're seeing graphic evidence that it's failing miserable and it's about to really harm everybody here, then that's the part where I don't understand what because he has to be aware of that. If President Trump is suffering cognitive decline, Rupert Murdoch doesn't appear to be. And certainly a lot of the executives at Fox News aren't the ones that are deciding who gets put on the television. By the way, I used to be a regular at Fox News, and now it's once in a blue moon that I get on there only when something happens. And that's not by design, or that's not by accident. That's by design, because no one else like me is on either. So I just don't understand. I mean, come up, help me understand, help me come up with some kind of plausible reason why they would want to push something that would harm our country when they know the war is not going to work.
You know, it appears to me that Murdoch is just part of that elite oligarchic class of the West that shares their same values and outlook. And because he's also a war whore on Russia, he has a huge Russophobic bias and has cheerled the Ukraine war all the way through. And it's he that sort of made Lindsey Graham a household figure. It's not like a bunch of other media were begging to have Lindsey Graham on. That was Fox more than anybody else over the last 20 plus years. And he's done that with who, you know, is able, like Tucker was able to be there for a while, but ultimately pushed Tucker out because of Tucker's anti-war proclivities as he became an anti-war advocate. Now, it competed at that point with Murdoch's desire and lust for money because Tucker was his cash cow at Fox. But this goes all the way back. And it really goes all the way back to his days in the UK in the 60s. I mean, he just seems to be an empire guy. He really believes in empire. And he believes in leveraging his own personal financial and news empire into promoting a Western US-UK global empire. And that he's sort of attached to it at the hip. And he's advocated, he's never deliberately hired anyone with any kind of skepticism towards war with any over any long time period. He ultimately got rid of Judge Napolitano in part for that reason, who he had there to try to bring in libertarians to Fox News brand. So, and I think also when Ailes was there, Ailes did provide some degree of counterbalance that because Ailes wasn't as deep. He was mostly a war promoter, but he wasn't obsessed with it the way Rupert was. I think now that Ailes is gone, there's no limitation, and you're just getting pure empire lover Murdoch on Fox News, and that's going to kill the very empire he wants to promote.
Yeah, and let me just show a couple of examples here from today where Mr. Murdoch there is moving in that direction. First of all, here's General Keane. He's going to be talking about how we have all the ammunition that we need to do this. We just need to go and finish the job.
What I have been told is that in the time that, obviously, there's 90 days we've been conducting a diplomatic effort, that we've come to full magazine depth again, and the Israelis are at full magazine depth as well. That is what I know. I think we've got to ask the administration about it. I'm confident we can execute the mission the president has given us in front of us. And the reason why I say that is because we're fully prepared to go back to major combat operations, which would be 2 weeks with a different set of targets than what we're pursuing right now, along with the Israelis. And if we're prepared to do that, where the targets are considerably more exhaustive than what we're dealing with the Straits of Hormuz, I think we're in good shape.
I think we're in good shape, he says, and we have all the ammunition we need, he says, and Israel is eager to come back in, and then that way we'll finally accomplish the mission President Trump has said. He never said which mission, because Trump has been literally all over the map of whatever mission he is, but whatever, who cares about that? As long as we go back in and shoot people and blow stuff up, then I guess he's happy, but this will not have a happy end, Robert. I mean, just look at the ammunition issue first. Because everything in the open source media has said that we're in grave shape with our important, especially the JASSMs and the Tomahawk long-range cruise missiles, the PAC-3 and the THAAD interceptors, in grave, you know, in red, we call it in the military. And now he wants to go back into full scale, not just 80 to 100 targets a day, but like it wasn't the first, where it was many hundreds potentially in some days. And, you know, and I think up to 15,000 were eventually used or so. We don't have it, Robert. And if Trump listens to him and Rupert Murdoch gets his way and we go back into full-scale war, we're going to run out of some of these categories of weapons.
I mean, it goes back to Curtis Bombs Away LeMay, who after World War II, he loved to firebomb Dresden, then loved firebombing Tokyo, then he wanted to nuke everybody and everywhere, loved air power, thought air power could solve everything. Back when we had a much better supply chain for our support of our military products than we do now. That was before the military-industrial complex had truly taken over. Eisenhower warned about it in 1961, but it's taken a whole new level now to where we are not able and capable to quickly restore our munitions. So Keane is just lying about that. You can almost see in his hesitating tone that he knows he's lying about it. We are not – where's Iran camp? Iran has built a self-sufficient military supply chain helped by Russia and China that's built deep underground, built, and they can build it for dirt cheap, contrary to Rubio saying, oh, they spend all their money on wars. And no, that's us. We're the ones blowing the budget on the wars. I think Iran spends 2% of its GDP on military support and support for any other Hezbollah or anyone else. The Hamas's money didn't come from Iran for the October 7th attack. Watch the documentary on Bibi Netanyahu. It came from Israel through Qatar. But it wasn't because Qatar was doing it voluntarily. Israel was directing them to do it because of their grand plan to split the Palestinian cause between the West Bank and Gaza geographically and geopolitically between Hamas and Fatah. And then that backfired on them. Shock, shock. Like all of our other policies and politics, getting into bed with head choppers and terror organizations has constantly and consistently backfired. Iran is not the threat to its neighbors. Iran has never invaded its neighbors. Iran has only attacked any neighbor when attacked and after being attacked. Otherwise, during this entire Islamic Republic of Iran, they have been one of the least initiating conflict countries in the Middle East, is the reality of it. We just pretend otherwise by projecting onto Iran what we or Israel has often and frequently done. Hussein had no idea to go into Iran by himself. We're the ones that got him, along with other countries, the Gulf countries, even the Soviet Union back in the time, to go after, because everybody saw the Islamic regime of Iran as a threat at that time. What people have never understood, though, is the Iranian people have never seen their government as a threat, the Islamic Republic as a threat. They see it as their protector, as the Shia have throughout the entire world. That's why the entire premise behind this strategy, that the Iranian people can't wait to replace their government with a pro-Israeli, pro-U.S. government, is always been completely false. It's been completely wrong. Unlike Syria, unlike Libya, unlike Iraq, where there were significant dissenting groups within the population, that is not true of the Iranian Republic, which we knew from our own public opinion surveys going back almost 50 years. It's right there in all the data. But that's why, we end up setting up a fake organization, do fake polls, and been preaching that. And Trump buys that fake data. Like, he was truly, one of the reasons he went back in is he was mad at how massive the rallies were in support of the deceased Ayatollah. He took it as a personal insult to his ego. That's where his logic is. His logic is like something out of a Shakespearean tragedy or out of an old Greek tragedy, like the original Greek tragedies, not the one Christopher Nolan has currently butchered on the movie screen. the real ones. And that's what Trump has become. He's become a tragic figure in the King Lear form who gets it personally ego enraged. How dare they have these mass rallies for this Ayatollah? I guarantee he was evil. They hated him. I know that he was evil. They hated him because I convinced myself of it. And to be shown the stupidity of my belief in the biggest ever human gathering for a single event in world history is something that his ego couldn't handle.
It couldn't, and that's, we're going to see where that's going to go. I want to show one more retired general, somebody we haven't had on very often here, General Spaulding. This is noteworthy, not just because he's saying, yeah, let's keep on fighting the war, but he seems to be laying the foundation that, hey, let's get into a new forever war.
How much longer do you expect this to go on, and do you think munitions should be a limitation at this point? What do you hear?
No, I don't think, the Pentagon has done a great job of restocking the munitions. I don't think that's an issue at all. But I do expect that we're going to be there a long time. Operation Northern Southern Watch went on for, almost 20 years, I think. So I think this is going to be something similar. We're going to have to stay there. Those guys aren't going to change their behavior. We have to adapt. And I think, we're going to have to get the Gulf states and those that rely on the oil coming from the Gulf states to help pay for this.
What is he talking about? This was literally the first time I'd seen. But here again, Fox News, Rupert Murdoch is trying now, I think, and we'll see if this continues on, to lay the foundation that, hey, this ain't going to be over anytime soon. And it's going to be our next forever war, which President Trump ran on saying he would never do. And now here we are. What do you make of that?
I mean, I know Vance is strongly opposed to it and strongly opposed to any ground troops of any kind. and particularly opposed to any kind of forever aspect. And there are Trump alternates between fears. Sometimes it's a fear of looking like Barack Obama and giving Rand money. Sometimes it's a fear of looking like Jimmy Carter and having hostages taken and having soldiers taken on, you know, on video, or having, say, casualties on video. Another humiliation that actually motivates him, you know, with Iran's got its team of shrinks now advising them how to deal with Trump. And one of the things they figured out is that he has a deep fear right now of humiliation. He didn't used to, but now it's an obsessive concern. There's always been a part of him that gets agitated by it. Some people still think he ran for president because Barack Obama humiliated him at the at that press event in D.C. some years ago. And there's probably some truth to that, knowing Trump. But now he fears it rather than motivates him in a potentially positive or productive way. So I think you'll see escalation by Iran talking about withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, put out rumors and ruminations that they may set off a nuclear weapon because of the humiliating effect. Not just as a practical deterrent, but more that Trump's whole reason for everything he's done on Iran since his first term was Iran cannot have nuclear weapons. What happens when his own conduct causes Iran to have nuclear weapons?
Right.
It's just humiliating at a level. It's just emasculating of Trump. So those are some of the fears that are there, along with the economy and the midterms. But and that's why I think, like, people talk about using ground troops. One, it's logistically, as Larry and you have pointed out, almost impossible. The Vance has told people that there's no chance we put troops on the ground in the islands or on Iran, that he does not see that is really in Trump's discussion. It's being floated by Trump because he still thinks it's motivation. He convinces himself Iran's just about to fold. Iran is just about to capitulate. He listens to the Fox News generals. They're on their last legs. I'll be able to, you know, if I threaten this, I bet they really fold. He's convinced himself the madman theory works. When the madman theory no longer works, if people think you're really mad, they have to think you're not really mad. If you're really mad, then they just put you on a random set of possibilities, like a game theory at a poker table. And all of a sudden it becomes counterproductive because they might escalate even more because they think you're really mad. And so it's not working. Vance knows it's not working. The military knows it's not working. The career people at the State Department and others know it's not working. The career intelligence people know it's not working. They knew the data that I talked about in terms of Iranian public opinion did not support overthrowing the regime, overthrowing its government, overthrowing the republic, as they consider it. Indeed, the average Iranian considers their government more democratic than the average American considers ours, which might surprise people.
Wow.
That's how they perceive it. When they, you know, you can rank it, how democratic is your country on a 0 to 10? They're over 5. We are often under 5 in surveys. When you ask people, are you free to speak your mind? They're actually split in Iran as to how free they are to speak their mind. Many Americans don't feel free to speak their mind because of the consequences over the last 6 years of various forms of censorship and punishment, and employment and educational settings, simply for speaking their mind. Most people at work don't feel that.
Let me ask you a question, because you mentioned a couple of times here, and I want to bring it in. Gareth, if you could bring up that Substack article. You just published this. Do the Iranian people want regime on your Substack here? Now, I had an interesting experience 2 or 3 weeks ago when I was heading to Georgia, and I was on the way to the airport, and my wife and I were in the backseat. We were just talking about some of this stuff. We were in an Uber, and I'd mentioned something about the Iranian people, and all of a sudden the Uber driver, an elderly woman, popped up and said, "Hey, you know what, boy, the President Trump is right, because the Iranian people desperately want this regime change. They love what he's doing. They want more bombs and everything else." And obviously I've seen a few people of those. Pahlavi was the cheerleader of that. But number one, you could just see, because the people surrounded the Ayatollah after it was over. And one theory was that, well, whatever dispute there was, because I've talked to somebody who was in the protest in January that almost spawned this in that month. And they said there was a lot of it was legitimate displeasure with the government on financial things, whatever, but it was a protest. It wasn't a turn them over. And then once we've seen them come together, but the question is, did that galvanizing thing, the rally around the flag, did that make that go away, or was it always overblown? What have you discovered?
So it was really always overblown. So there's a range of surveys that have been done of Iran and of Shia populations, which ended up becoming a key factor in other countries outside of Iran. And this includes polls done by Gallup, polls done by Reuters, polls done by the Pew Research Institute, surveys done by the University of Maryland, by the Sadat professor there for the study of the Middle East and the world. Studies by the Washington Institute for the Near East. So the polls I used are entirely U.S.-based pollsters. Now, there's another poll based out of the Netherlands, which is the one that's often being cited by the Fox News crowd. And that poll, when you research it, is not an actual real pollster. The survey, the way they're surveying Iran is very unusual. The software they're using is intelligence-created software. They were founded by regime change advocates. They are funded by regime change advocates, and they are propagated by regime change advocates. And they have no history of success at all polling anywhere in the world in terms of predicting elections or other things. So others, Gallup has, Reuters has, Pew Research has, Washington Institute for the Near East has, and the University of Maryland has. And they've extensively polled Iran, but also the Shia populations around the Middle East. And what you find is the common denominator is that the Islamic Republic of Iran finds deep and enthusiastic support ever since its founding in 1979 among Shia, religiously observant Shia, anywhere you find them anywhere in the world. It doesn't matter if they're here in the U.S., in the U.K., in Pakistan, in Bahrain, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq. No matter where you survey, you find support for the Republic of Iran. You get varying supports for individual leaders within Iran, whether different ayatollahs or different presidents or different foreign ministers that they have. That can go up and down depending on the circumstances or situation, whether perception of it, Iran abandoning Hezbollah or supporting it, abandoning or supporting the Palestinian cause, etc. But what you find is that within Iran itself, they've been very consistent. They see the Shia government as protecting the Shia in a world swamped by Sunni. Now, I would note where you don't have a big Shia-Sunni split, like Malaysia and Indonesia, you find consistent 70% plus approval of the Islamic Republic of Iran in almost every survey ever done there. So they see it predominantly as an Islamic regime. The Shia see it as a predominantly Shia protectorate. That's why it's very popular in Pakistan, Bahrain, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq. All those countries where you'll find very strong support. Hence, it wouldn't be a surprise of mass participation in the funeral for the murdered Ayatollah and his granddaughter. People are underestimating the impact of his 4-year-old granddaughter in that tiny little casket. Not just the girls' schools. It's seeing that little casket of that granddaughter.
Yeah, that was hard to watch.
Yeah, completely. The president should be smacked in the face and reminded of that when he wants to go on these lectures about these things. And then within Iran, exactly what the person you talked to said, they are unhappy with how the Republic has managed their economy. They have various levels of approval of individual leaders, just like the U.S., just like the U.K. or Germany or France. Though I would note, the Iranian Republic's opinion polls have never been as bad about any Iranian leader as right now in Germany, right now in France, and right now in the U.K. Just a little highlighted point there. They've never been 80% plus.
Important point.
Yeah. And what you dig in, you find is about anywhere the peak of changing the government is at 20% at any time period. It is now, because of everything that's happened, in the low, like 4 or 5%. It's in the hardcore dissidents that are still present in the country. Now, it is fair to say a good number of the dissidents over time have left Iran, dating back to 1980. So some of those dissident populations no longer live in Iran. And that, too, tends to be misrepresentative because the Iranians who live outside of Iran, especially in the West, are disproportionately not religiously observant Shia. And that's what misleads it. In Iran, it's 95% plus religiously observant Shia. And that's what's important to understand is that that's the common denominator in their deep religious ties to their governing system. But they also see their government as democratic. And that's why they hold them accountable for economics. They don't see them as this oligarch elite that's enriching itself. They see them as responsible to them and frequently incompetent in handling economic issues because they don't blame the sanctions as much as they blame their local leaders. But that's been the sole source of protest. There's been sporadic protests over, hey, we don't like these cultural rules being so restrictive. But that's more of a generational phenomenon. The Zoomer generation, millennial generation, doesn't want to be part of the boomer. That's the same thing you're seeing all across the West and here in the U.S. But Iran has, what's been missed is Iran's government has, over the last half decade, softened the enforcement of those rules. They only have a burqa, not the whole hijab, and they mostly don't enforce it anymore. So there's a range of those rules they don't strictly enforce. Now it's worthwhile to note that there's a hardcore third of the population that wants it enforced. So there's a third that is deeply fundamentalist still and wants that kind of strict enforcement, and that's also underappreciated. But basically, you've never had more than 20% that have wanted to overthrow their government. It's right now in the low single digits. They're all unhappy about the economy and want it to be better. But that's like every population pretty much everywhere around the world at the moment.
Right.
But they've never wanted their government overthrown. They've always opposed their government overthrown. And then because the support for changing the entire system of government peaked at 20% over a decade ago. It's been going down steadily. And the reasonable inference is they can see Syria, they can see Iraq, they can see Libya, they can see Lebanon. They're like, we do not want to be those governments. And the Persians have a history of being invaded, of being attacked. They've been very successful at resisting that over time. But particularly the century before the lead up to the Islamic Republic of Iran, they were subject to constant interventions. Part of their distrust of Russia goes all the way back to the Soviet Union and what happened during World War II. So because of it, that animates it even deeper. Like if you ask them, do you want the U.S. government to come in and overthrow them? Based on all the data I've seen, that specific question hasn't been asked. My guess is you'd be lucky to get 1%. So the Trump's entire premise for this war has been completely false from day one. Indeed, he keeps reinforcing the very things that motivate and rally the Iranian public around the current Iranian Republic. The Iranian people rally behind the existing government because what they definitely don't want is a violent overthrow of their regime that could lead to chaos, and especially if it is done on the behest and behalf of Israel and the United States, whose government have had consistently very negative opinions in Iran since before the actual revolution, because this goes back to from 53 to 79, the U.S. and the U.K. being blamed for overthrowing their democratic governance and putting in the Shah. So all the assumptions have been faulty from day one. People can go to the Substack. I've hyperlinked all the polling survey data. These are all U.S. sources, not anybody else. People who have done, the University of Maryland has specialized in how to get these questions asked in the right phraseology to the Iranian public. And they've been consistent and predictive at a whole bunch of countries in the Middle East and in the U.S. They survey generally. Not like this fake Gamin group that people keep citing as if it's legitimate when it's literally funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, which screams warning sign, red flag, and has never done successful polling of any place, anywhere in the world. But they can see right there, and you can click on the hyperlinks, and you can dig into the polling data yourself. You've got 12 years of it at the University of Maryland. You've got 40 years of it over time in all of these other places. And it's not, once you understand that about Iran, then you just start looking up the opinion of Shia in other countries. And there's no reason for the Shia in those countries to lie about their opinion of Iran if you have some, you know, pretext about whether you think reliable survey data can come out of Iran. There you get the same numbers. In fact, what's fascinating is the Iranian public has not wanted to do things like nuclear weapons following the Shah's, following the Ayatollah's fatwa. But you'll find when they've done that survey of Shia in Lebanon or Shia in Iraq or Shia in Bahrain or Shia in Pakistan, what you find is they say, no, Iran should develop nuclear weapons. We think it would be an important deterrence to protect the Shia around the world. So I suspect that's where the Shia now in Iran is trending after the war. But that gives you an idea of just how sympathetic and supportive the Shia is. This is their protectorate. It's not the dispensationalist nonsense version of it that you get from some people on the evangelical right in the U.S., where they pretend it's Iran that has this aggressive, prophetic, want to end the world for their religion viewpoint. That's not Iran at all, if you study what the Ayatollah...
They're religious Nazis, Lindsey Graham said while he was alive. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, it's like, they're not the ones doing this. It's if you go to certain Christian Zionist churches in the United States is where you hear that nonsense. Listen to Huckabee, and that's where you hear the nonsense. We're going to bring in the rapture, brother. We're going to bring it in again. And people should really study what a lot of that Christian Zionist stuff means. It means all the Jews die, just FYI. So if anybody thinks the Israelis are truly Zionists, or Christian Zionists, that is, then ask yourself, Have they figured out what the dispensationalist prophetic ending is for them? It's you need to die so Jesus can come back. Would you help facilitate that? I mean, it's insanity on steroids.
That's the movement. Someone who does follow Christianity, real Christianity, that is not what it teaches. I mean, just be crystal clear on that. Okay, so if that whole thing that we used at the start of this war is to say, oh, we're going to go and help them overthrow their government, if that was always nonsense, then what we're doing now, what we're seeing with these tens of millions of people that came out and knew that they were risking their lives because they knew that by gathering they could become targets, et cetera, but they didn't care. They just went on. We had Ahmad Suleiman who contacted me shortly after. He was there during a lot of these, during all the funeral, actually. And he said that there was one common theme he saw everybody talk to, which is that if they had to sacrifice half of their population, you know, like 40 million people, in order to defeat the United States and Israel, they said that would be a price worth paying. They don't want to, obviously, but they said that they are so adamant on never giving into anything. So that tells me, and the physical evidence that we have and the military stuff, which you've already mentioned, is that there's no path, zero path, that any military force, any military attrition from the United States would ever harm Iran enough that would make them say, all right, fine, we'll do whatever you want to do. I don't see that is even being a theoretical possibility. Do you?
Oh, agreed. I mean, I told people at the very beginning of this, if you understood Shia sacrifice, Persian pride, and Iranian nationalism, you would know this is never going to work, that we can never conquer or never get them to capitulate. It's like a Russian once told me, we'd rather eat dirt than give up our pride. And Persian pride runs somehow even deeper. I mean, these are people who converted the Mongols. Mongols came in, technically conquered the Persians, and within a generation, they've all become Persians. They did that to the Mongols. I mean, you did it to Genghis Khan. It was like, it's like why we go to Vietnam. It was like the one country that beat the Mongols twice. That's who we're going to invade. This is insanity on steroids. And this is a Shia religion built on sacrifice. It believes in sacrifice. Its foundation is its sacrifice and martyrdom. So, I mean, that's why the Ayatollah was brilliant. He knew I stay put, let him take me out. I got cancer, I'm going to die. And here I get to die one of the greatest martyrs in the history of my nation. So you combine Persian pride with Shia sacrifice. You knew that there was no chance they were ever going to give up. And Trump is just delusional. Trump convinces himself that in his mindset, I mean, people should ask themselves, why is Trump at different levels being unduly and unnecessarily antagonistic against his political promises, against three cultures at the same time? The civilization of China and its trade war, the civilization of Russia by continuing to propagate the Ukraine war and brag about our deep strikes into Russia at a time we really can't afford it on economic and oil and gas reasons, while continuing to escalate against Iran. That little meme of him being a Russian emperor is something he actually believes in. Regime change documented it. He said, look at all these leaders. And what leaders was he citing as examples? Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun. He'd even print it out. He goes, look at all the power they have. I got more power than them. He fancied himself the emperor from Caracas to Tehran, from Beijing to Moscow. That when you get that mindset, you deliberately take on the most powerful civilizations in the world. The Russians, the Chinese, and the Persians are the three civilizations that have withstood the longest set of attacks of any civilizations in our world. You would know, don't get in a land war with Russia. Don't try to bluff the Chinese, and don't try to conquer the Persians. And Trump is trying to do all three. There's no better evidence, the guys. Cuckoo.
So where can we go? Because here's what we're at right now. I think you've just laid out a very compelling argument that there will be no military victory, period. No matter how much more we get, if Jack King gets everything he asked for, General Kellogg, General Spaulding, whatever, they all get all they want. Rupert Murdoch gets his way. We're going to run out of bullets. It's on the news right now. I think the CSIS had put something out to here a couple of days ago that talked about how long it would take to replace a lot of these things. An SM-3 missile takes 64 months. Even a Patriot takes, it turns out it's probably less than half, maybe a couple of years. But still, even if it's the lower end of that, to make one missile, meaning that we cannot replace what we're shooting here every single day and have been for weeks. We will literally run out if we try to do this again in 40 days of the key things. And then we're going to just be, I don't know, throwing rocks at them. Who knows what we're going to do, but we'll never defeat them. Now the Bab al-Mandab is allegedly shut down. The Strait of Hormuz definitely is shut down. Nothing's rolling. Just trickles is coming out of it. And the insufficient oil supply is continuing to compound on top of the helium, the fertilizers, the sulfurs, all the other kind of derivatives that are also blocked out of there. Where are we going if President Trump keeps trying to go military?
That's the problem. I mean, every day that this war continues in any kind of kinetic fashion without honoring some sort of diplomatic agreement like the Memorandum of Understanding and without just simply withdrawing from the region in the conflict is a day that it's a distraction from his other actually popular domestic agenda items like reforming elections with the SAVE Act. So he's losing political capital daily. He's losing political support daily just by what issues are not being discussed nationwide. Secondly, it's another day of a risk of casualties, of risk of injuries to U.S. personnel for a war Americans have never believed in. That's another day of diminishing political capital going into the tick-tock of the clock of the midterm elections. Then you've got the third component, which is that the economic impact and ramifications gets worse day by day by day, some of which may be to some degree irreversible. It may accelerate an AI bubble pop that could pop the stock market bubble that could in turn pop the consumer spending bubble, since half of consumer spending currently takes place by the top 10% who own all the stocks. And then on top of that, you have the oil and energy cost at the pump, which we're seeing show up in interest rates rising, which we can't afford with our debt reaching record levels, even higher than World War II as a percentage of GDP, exactly the opposite of what President Trump promised. So instead of sub $3 gas, you get over $4 gas. Instead of sub $4 diesel, you get over $5 diesel. Instead of affordable interest rates, you get the highest interest rate since the global financial crisis. Instead of reducing debt, you get a debt that is cannibalizing the budget on a regular basis. And all of this in an economic and political environment that's already hostile and adverse. And then we're just months away now from the general elections in November. And what happens if it's a wipeout in the House, wipeout in the Senate? Well, what does that mean? It means investigations into all the corruption allegations. It means impeachment inquiries up the wazoo. And what's going to protect him from getting convicted in the Senate when so many of the Republican would-be Brutuses in the Senate can't wait to stab him in the back anyway and anyhow? And then he's on the clock of being the first president ever removed from the White House. So that's the risk he faces every single day he lets this go on.
And what do you think the chances of, let's look at a black swan event. Who can say what the real chances of this are? You alluded to it earlier in this broadcast. I've heard it from several different sources now, not even just one or two, that it is possible that Iran may have been shoved into making a nuclear weapon, and we may just be shocked one day when there is this nuclear detonation in the middle of the Iranian desert somewhere, and they declare, like the North Koreans did at one point, we're now a nuclear weapon state, and then everything is radically changed from that. It seems to me there'll be the first attempt by the White House will be to say, see, I told you so. This is why we were doing this the whole time. But I think that enough people are going to say, there was no nuclear weapons program by your own assessment. In Tulsi Gabbard in 2025 and 2026, they still had not gone to do that. And now they've been forced into it. And now the very thing we were supposed to preserve, prevent, you have caused. Is there any chance that even with this Congress and Senate, that he could be impeached if brought up on it?
I think it's unlikely he'd be removed at any time before changeover in elections, because so many Republicans, especially in the House, depend on some degree of Trump likability in the electorate amongst the Republican base to get out to vote, to salvage any chance of as many House seats as possible. So that's why he knows his risk is only with the post-January 2027 new House of Representatives and new Senate. That's when his risk really accumulates. And so he's got some freedom of action between now and then. The problem for him is that freedom of action is constrained by what he does now could impact what that House and Senate looks like then, what public opinion looks like then. Because it's the combination of where he stands in public opinion come January 2027 and the nature of the House and the Senate and its partisan makeup that are going to determine how plausible their investigations are, how thorough and complete and detailed those investigations are, and how likely impeachment and removal become.
And it seems that there is a plausible case here that, I mean, number one, you can say you flat out violated the 1973 War Powers Act by taking the country fully to war without going to Congress first. It's right there. I mean, you know it better than anybody. Maybe you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think that he went to war completely against the Constitution and that War Powers Act, and there's room to take him up there. And then when you can, in the course of discovery, you can say, look, you were told by your intelligence community, you were told by your generals, this would never work, and yet you did it anyway. I mean, that seems to be a high crime and misdemeanor.
And not only that, the other problem is how many people jump ship. The problem with a cabinet of cowards is you end up with a lot of rats and would-be rats and eager rats who are never going to sacrifice their personal and political future for yours. And they will quickly turn the knife in. The irony is the person who's been the most critical of Trump inside the White House is the one who would be the most loyal. Vance is the one who would be the last to abandon and sabotage and betray and play Brutus. Everyone else that's been the docile sycophants are the ones that are the snakes that Trump has led inside the house. Mm. To, you know, refer to his old poem, The Snake. You knew who I was when I let you in.
Right. And that will come back to be played a lot in the future, I suspect.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's his risk. These are people that abandoned him in a heartbeat. Israel Lobby will sabotage him in a heartbeat. Rupert Murdoch will sabotage him in a heartbeat. First, the first leader to endorse and praise Joe Biden for winning the 2020 election was Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel. That's how quickly he was to stick that knife in. So that's who these people are. You know, you can't get in with a bunch of traitors and thieves and expect them to have any honor when the equation and the occasion calls for it. So I think that's one of his other problems is that these, and if you notice, Rubio has played both sides of the fence throughout this whole thing, leaked one side and then said the opposite publicly or vice versa. And so you're going to continue to see that Ratcliffe the same way. They completely undermined his chance to challenge the 2020 election by saying it has something to do with China and Venezuela when that had nothing to do with what happened in 2020. What happened was old-fashioned ballot stuffing the old-fashioned way, good Democrats know how to do well. I grew up with some of them who explained how it worked. Even sabotage that part of his domestic political agenda, all for their war cause. And there's corruption scandals all over the place. There's a new one burgeoning with the Paramount Warner merger that's going to expose the Ellisons in the Israel lobby for trying to capture all of American media and cultural institutions or have a de facto monopoly over them, done through hiring lobbyists who did not register as lobbyists, who have tight ties throughout the Trump administration and literally monetized it for their personal self-enrichment that will implicate even Trump family members in the connections they have. So all of those scandals will be shocking, and the risk that the whole world discovers them quicker rather than later accumulates the longer this war continues, because it increases the risk he loses by big margins in the House and the Senate, which in turn create the removal and investigation risk.
Well, that day is coming. I think it's already baked in, and I don't think he can undo it now, and it doesn't look like he's even trying. We'll have to wait and see how it comes out. Listen, really appreciate you coming on the show today. And by the way, just want to remind everybody, here in just a couple of weeks, actually less than a couple of weeks now.
It's about 10 days.
About 10 days from now, 1776 Law Center is going to have its is it an annual or is it just
it's the annual, but it's a special quarter millennial celebration of the America Founding Conference, August 1st and August 2nd in Chattanooga, Tennessee. There's only a few tickets left, so if you want to get them now. You know, hop right on 1776lawcenter.com. 2 days long, over a dozen guests, including the one and only Daniel Davis, also including Larry Johnson, Alexander Makoros coming all the way in from London, Alex Christoforou coming all the way in from Cyprus, Jim Webb is coming in, Joe Kent's going to try to make it, Chase Hughes about how you defend and defuse a CIA psyop who was just on with Joe Rogan, behavior panel about how do you detect deception and communicate honestly, Scott Rouse and Greg Hartley. Greg Hartley was the guy they used to send as an interrogator because he could speak Arabic to stop a terrorist event around the world. So you know, he's a fascinating guy. He got a great history. The Richard Barris, People's Pundit Daily, about the future of the four freedoms. I describe people as it's the Bilderberg for the freedom movement or the anti-Bilderberg. The goal is We're going to have a lot of discussion about independent campaigns, third-party options and alternatives. Some prominent people are going to try to make some surprise visits and appearances. But you know, you provide dinner, brunch, snacks, drinks, a whole bunch of other stuff. Going to have a cool – we're going to even try to get a 1776-style specialized dessert for everybody. So you can just go to 1776lawcenter.com. And if you want to grab a snag a ticket, grab it today. And it's going to be a fun and exceptional event.
Yeah, I cannot wait to be there. That's going to be great. We'll definitely be reporting on that afterwards, maybe even reporting live from there. We'll wait and see how that's going to turn out. Thanks so much for coming on today. Always appreciate you. We'll see you the next time. And we'll see you guys on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.